roll with me.
Let's get the Government Operations Committee called to order. And Representative Purcell. Representative Hillstrom, it's going to be quickly, we hope. House File 157.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it needs to go to Civil Law next.
Representative Hillstrom, Civil Law has told us they don't need to see it.
Oh, great.
The motion I have here is to send it to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
Perfect, Mr. Chair.
I hear that chair is difficult to work with.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Anyway, I'll move House File 157 to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary and Finance Policy Committee. Representative Hellstrom, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill was brought to me by the Attorney General's office, and this relates to people who sell bullion coins and bullion coin dealers. And so we've been working very, very hard on this proposal, and I believe that we have come a long way to get some consensus on this, Mr. Chair. I believe that you have one amendment.
There's an A1 amendment. Do you wish that to be put on?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the A1 amendment to be author's amendment to be put on House File 157. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's approved. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all the amendment did is once you figure out who's really doing the selling of these of the bullion or the coins, auctioneer said if they're not actually the owner or the seller, they're just the facilitator of the sale, they shouldn't have to be under these requirements. And so that's all that was doing, was making certain that when we're talking about dealers, that we're actually talking about the real dealers. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Frickdee from the Attorney General's office.
Thank you, sir. And please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. And we are dealing with the rules. There's rulemaking in this, I believe, and setting with task force. Is that what they're... Go ahead with the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kermit Frickdee. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Attorney General's office. And to answer your first question, I don't believe this bill contains rulemaking in it. What the bill is designed to do is get at the problem of fraudulent and unscrupulous coin dealers. The office has repeatedly seen complaints from companies both here and throughout the country that prey on consumers, especially senior citizens. What I want to first address is what the bill doesn't do. It doesn't cover, it only covers gold coins. It doesn't cover jewelry, it doesn't cover gold bars, it doesn't cover investments in silver and gold, the actual metals. It also exempts those who engage in less than 5 transactions a year or in more transactions than that where the aggregate value is $5,000. It doesn't cover wholesale transactions, so if you're a coin wholesaler selling to coin dealers, you are not covered by this. This bill deals with coin companies that are selling coins, investment coins, directly to consumers. Now, I want to give you a little history of what our office has seen and what's happened. In the past couple of years, we brought 4 consumer protection cases starting in February of 2011. That was against a company called Reputable Rare Coin and an individual named Tory Hughes. Mr. Hughes essentially took people's money and never gave them the coins. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, he induced people to either send him coins that he was going to appraise and either trade for something else or buy from him, and he just kept the coins. He also arranged sales with people, and he kept their money. This is a common theme we've seen. There was another case that we brought against a company called Crescent Equities and Robert Gundy in March of 2011. That also resulted in a judgment against Mr. Gundy for the same conduct. There are 2 cases currently pending, one that was filed in November in Ramsey County against a company called the Stella Group and its owner, Tiffany Grady. Ms. Grady is not actively defending that case, and we imagine we will have it settled fairly soon. And there is another one pending against a company called Guardian Gold and Silver Exchange. one of the common things that we've noticed in all these cases, in almost every instance, there were individuals with criminal backgrounds that were now selling to people. And these people, many of them had criminal backgrounds for forgery, fraud, things like that, where they never should have been dealing with individuals' money. They were high-pressure sales tactics, often aimed at senior citizens, and they almost all took place through the mail. While these places did have brick-and-mortar offices, sometimes they were run out of their house or out mailboxes, etc. These were not, you'll be hearing testimony from someone in the industry later on, and I think his business is very different than what the ones that are being targeted by this bill. What the bill does, it places enforcement authority with the Commerce Department, requires registration, bars certain individuals with felony or fraud convictions, judgments for failure to pay consumers, or those that have engaged in settlements with law enforcement, such as the Attorney General's office, from participating in this industry. It lists a number of types of conduct that are prohibited, and requires a surety bond. And I wanted to also add that the Department of Commerce supports this bill, and so does the AARP. And we did receive, both of the authors received a letter from AARP in support of the bill. And with that, I would stand for any questions that you may have.
And Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want you to know that we are working with the Department of Commerce on making certain that it's really clear you know, what the registrar is going to be responsible. And so, Mr. Chair, we will continue to work with all interested parties.
And Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Fricke, Mr. Shepard here told me the part of the bill that we're concerned about is on lines 2.23 to 2.28, dealing with exempting them from rulemaking. So questions of the bill? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious on line 3.13. It says the commissioner shall not accept a registration for a coin dealer representative who has, et cetera, been convicted of in any court of any felony. I was just wondering why you decided any felony. There, I think, a few felonies that have nothing to do with financial, you know, for example, a DW, you know, aggravated DWI, other charges, and I'm just wondering why you decided any felony instead of laying out the more financial types of felonies.
Mr. Fricke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I think part of the reason is you mentioned it, DWI. That was one of the crimes that many of these people had in addition to several others, and I think that part of this was patterned after some of the other statutes dealing with DHS disqualifications and other commerce disqualifications. But I think that I would defer to Representative Hillstrom on whether or not any felony should be a bar.
Representative Hillstrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, with what I do, I think it should be, but I guess that's for the committee to decide as well.
Thank Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. Well, I don't know. I guess I'd encourage you to look at that because it seems like, you know, if somebody has a felony on their record, it's pretty hard to get back into the mainstream. And when we're, you know, I mean, people have a right to live after they've served their time. And 15 years just seems like a long time, especially if it's something that's unrelated to, I can see if it's financial related. But if it's a felony that's unrelated to this type of a crime, it just seems a little harsh to me. I also have a question on line 5.4 to 5.6, and I see that whole section ADG.07 would be a misdemeanor if any of those things are done, it looks like. And it says misrepresenting the value of the bullion coins, the delivery date of coins, or payment for coins, or the dealer representative's professional qualifications, affiliations, or registration. I just don't know very much about the industry, and I'm not sure how often the value of bullion coins change. I guess my concern is that if it's something that changes quite frequently, I'm worried that someone might be in a position where they in good faith believe that they're giving the correct value of the bullion coins, but because of the market, they're not able to do it, or they make a mistake, and then they would get a misdemeanor if they in good faith thought that they were representing the value of the bullion. Or, you know, also the delivery date of coins. you know, sometimes that's hard. If you're purchasing it, and you're told by the seller you're getting it, and you're the, you know, the middleman, so to speak, it seems like there could be a lot of room for just a mistake that isn't in bad faith. It's just, you know, due to circumstances beyond their control. And I'm just wondering, it just seems a little harsh. If maybe you could talk a little bit first about kind of the bullion market, and then second about kind of the, seems a little harsh, and if you could just kind of address that.
Mr. Fricke, this is outside our purview, but if you can answer it quickly and succinctly, it would be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the only Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2 violations of that would be the misdemeanor. So subdivision, if misrepresenting the value wouldn't be a wouldn't be a misdemeanor.
Right. Could
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Fricke, could you just talk about the volatility of the market? Just because I don't have a background in that, and I was just kind of curious to have more understanding of the bill.
Mr. Fricke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this isn't the... Many times consumers are approached by coin salesmen saying, well, the value of silver is going up. So your coin, and they try to make a link between the silver market or the a precious metals market and the value of a coin, when in fact, many times, because the value, the weight of a coin is small compared to its value. These coins aren't being sold based on their melt value. They're being sold on some collectible value, whether it's rarity or something else. So misrepresenting the value of the bullion coins, the cases that we've seen is where someone will say, I can sell you these coins at $50 a coin. I will sell you 1,000 of them. Pretty common transaction. Well, when in fact, they're instead of $50 a coin, they're maybe worth $4 or $5 a coin. We're not talking about differences in exchange rates or things like that or commissions. We're talking about a vast swing. It's almost like a substituting something for something else.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Fricke. And then... that's helpful in understanding the market. But going back to clauses 1 and 2, which is a misdemeanor, it's still, clause 1 still talks about failure to deliver bullion coins to a consumer within the time agreed upon within the consumer. And I'm also kind of wondering what control, I don't know enough about the market to understand what kind of control or if there's a middleman or where the dealer would buy them from. What I'm getting at is, do they actually have control over that? I mean, if I'm promised I'm going to get something and then I'm going to sell it, I may in good faith intend to do that, but if through circumstances beyond my control I can't do that, then all of a sudden you get a misdemeanor, and I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how that process works.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Pepin. Actually, the industry would like some of that time to be shorter on delivery, and so we've actually been told by... some of the legitimate dealers that that actually could be a shorter time frame, and we kept our time frame where it is because we think that would be reasonable at this point. So I don't want that to be a concern for you, given the fact that the industry is saying that even the timeline that we have in here is longer than they'd be okay with.
Representative Pepin, and again, we're delving into judiciary and those parts. That's not part of what our purview is, but we can make it short. Be great.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to understand the process, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand how long it takes how it works that the dealer gets the bullion to start with. I understand that they want the time to be shorter, but I'm saying if it's outside of your control, I don't want to penalize someone if something happens that's outside their control, and I'm not understanding how the market works that would allow them to guarantee always that they're going to be able to deliver in that time, because that's just not how life works. Sometimes it's difficult to make a delivery deadline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, in some cases the dealer actually has the coins. In fact, most of the representations are, I have these coins. Now, in a situation where the dealer doesn't and tells the consumer, we'll make this deal, I will go get the coins, the bill would allow them to do that because it allows them to agree on another time. The language of the statute... talks about within 30 days unless there's another agreement. So this would allow a coin dealer to say, I will go get you these coins. It may take me longer. Are you okay with that? And they can move forward with that deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is delving into judiciary, and I'm not sure that I'm totally comfortable with that answer, but I'll move on for now.
Representative Drazkowski, and try and keep it to our purview, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fricke and Representative Hillstrom, The part that the chair has drawn to our consideration is on page 2, the rulemaking process. Why are we exempting the government from the rulemaking process with this particular bill?
Representative Hilster, Mr. Fricke?
Sure.
And that's a question I had in my mind, too. That's what's
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm reviewing this section again. I think that without speaking for the Department of Commerce, this is something that our office and Representative Hilstrom have been working with the Department of Commerce on, and it has to do with how they implement the actual applications and more technical issues. But other than that, I would defer to the Department of Commerce on that.
Is there somebody here from the Department of Commerce that can answer that question?
What's included in
Please identify yourself for the tape. And
I'm Nancy Lepink, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Enforcement with the Department of Commerce.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. The response to the question is that, first of all, this language is in the bill, though was not put in the bill by the Department of Commerce. So I'm assuming it was put in the bill on the recommendation of the reviser or counsel. But the purpose of it would be is, first of all, it's limited to exempting the agency from rulemaking related to the creation of the application form and the requirements of the form and what would need to be put provided as part of an application in order for us to review it and then just make the call as to whether or not to issue the registration. So my sense of this is it's to allow for an expeditious implementation of this act with a fairly straightforward
and creating the form
required information that would be part of that application process in order for then us to process the registration. And with a very, you know, rulemaking can be a rather lengthy process, and so consequently implementing this in a timely way requiring a rulemaking process would then result in delays.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't catch the gal's name, but
Nancy Lepik.
Lepik, thank you, Ms. Lepik. You know, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Hilstrom, this car seems to be headed down the road so quick. The wheels are trying to come off of it. I don't know where the fire is here. Why are we trying to exclude the ability of the public to have input into the development of the application? I listened to Mr. Fricke. Did he say there's 4 different violations in the last 3 years or something like that, or 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we have 4 lawsuits that we brought. We've received well over 100 complaints. Also, there was a gentleman that just pled guilty to federal fraud charges that operated a company called IRC. That company is where many of these people eventually came from, but there have been 5 companies that have been had legal action taken against them within the last 2 years.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Fricke. So that brings the broader question for the need for the bill. It seems to me that we have laws in place for many of these things already. I mean, that individual's on his way to federal court. He's getting his medicine. What about the rest of the elements of this bill? Aren't there recourse already? Many of these behaviors are already criminal behaviors in law. If you enter into a contract and you don't deliver, I expect that there are consequences for that in law. So I'm really concerned about the existence of the bill to begin with. And then, Mr. Chair, and I understand we're not supposed to go beyond this, but I look at the bottom of pages 4 and 5 and all of these prohibited conducts, and we say on line 5.18 that they will lose their license if they violate any other Minnesota rule or law. So a parking ticket will give you the ability to remove the license of somebody to operate their business in Minnesota. That's what I read here. This bill just seems to be written so overbearingly and quickly. I struggle with the bill generally, not to mention the rulemaking provisions, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Putting us more on a global basis, and again, it's maybe slightly outside of rulemaking, but it does help, I think, with this. We have federal regulation and state regulation, and I'm just wondering if the author or the other two testifiers could tell us what under federal law right now would cover this. We certainly would have some interstate commerce that would take place here that would kick it to the federal level. What kind of penalties, and why would we need to have a separate state statute governing this topic?
Mr. Fricke.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, there is no federal law other than federal criminal laws governing this. These kind of dealers aren't regulated by they aren't licensed by the FTC, by the SEC. And to get to the earlier question about why do we need this, certainly there are criminal laws that deal with this, and these folks can and do go to jail. But that doesn't help the problem of the retiree whose retirement nest egg has been stolen, and that's what we've been seeing, or the person who's engaged in a reverse mortgage so that they can buy coins, or someone who's cashed in an IRA because they're being sold something that's as safe as an IRA. So this is more to provide the financial penalty and the financial safety. Will any law such as this prevents a career criminal from stealing from someone? No, but this will. The design of this bill is to prevent people from having their money stolen and giving them some sort of recourse, and that's why there's the licensure and registration requirements and the surety bond.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. The Better Business Bureau doesn't usually come and testify on proposals, and they've had so many complaints in this area that they actually came and testified in support of this proposal and doing something. And I actually have someone from the industry if they'd like to hear from folks who actually do this, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we let the gentleman testify? Thanks, Ms. Ludwig.
Thank you for letting me.
And before you start, members, this, like I said, the part we're dealing with here is just the rulemaking exemption for the application. We can continue asking questions on this, and we can come back this evening after 6 o'clock. We have a room reserved if we want to drag this out longer. I mean, but sir, testify. Give us your name for the testimony or for the tape, and be short with your testimony.
My name is Bill Gale. I'm president of Asset Marketing Services, coin company, numismatic company in Burnsville. We employ about 406 Minnesotans. We are in favor of something to try to clean up the industry because there definitely has been issues in the industry. We've been working with Representative Hillstrom in the AG's office with wording, and we're continuing with that. But there's no question that there has been people in the industry that have been bad, and not only have they taken advantage of consumers, I'm sitting here as a company that's been taken advantage of, because not only do they do it on the retail side, but they're also doing it in the industry itself. Whether they're stealing confidential information from customers or from other companies, Guardian Precious Metals, we actually had litigation against them because they were able to get confidential information and then take advantage of those people. So there is issue in the industry.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add a brief, colorful anecdote. Just a little flavor of what this IRC group was like. I actually worked in the same building that they were operated out of for about 5 years, and the talk of everybody else in the building was just exactly what criminal enterprise they were engaged in, because based on all of their conduct, all of their behavior, all of their appearance, it was very clear that this was some sort of criminal activity, but we didn't really know what International Rarities Group was looked like. The owner was about 6'6". I bet he was, 250 pounds of muscle. He had a white Mercedes. Everybody who worked there was a smoker. Everybody there was talking about pressure to hit their numbers all the time. And most of them looked like they had just come out of jail. So I think the idea of trying to police some of these groups out of the industry is something that makes a lot of sense for the good operators. And when I heard that he was charged in federal court, I was not surprised in the least. Although he was a really nice guy in the elevator.
Any further questions for the testifier? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that I have any more questions. I would just like to say that I would encourage members to vote against the bill today because I think it's a bad precedent we seem to be heading down this year, exempting from the rulemaking process. No public input. I don't see an appeals process here. I believe that's in Chapter 14 as well. And then also the language says, at a minimum, the application must include the following. And so presumably there could be a lot more stuff added on. And, you know, I think this isn't the first time we've seen an exemption from rulemaking. The very important Hicks bill we're hearing also is looking to exclude from the rulemaking process. And there's a reason that we're here, and that's because it's our job, because we're elected and we're to be held accountable by the people. But when we continue to put the rulemaking process in state agency, or when we continue to turn over the power to state agencies and we limit the rulemaking process, or in this case completely remove the rulemaking process and the appeal process, and then you know, pretty much put unlimited restrictions on what the agency can include in the application. And then just some of the things that I talked about any felony, it just seems like this is a really overreaching bill. So I would encourage members to vote against it today.
Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify for or against this bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Now that that point has been raised, can we have an explanation about why it needs to be exempt from the rulemaking provision?
Representative Kahn, we did get that question earlier by the Department of Commerce. What the rulemaking exemption is for is just to create an application. That's the only part that the rulemaking exemption is for, is the exemption from having to take the application to the through the rulemaking process.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Skousen.
If I could help, what I remember Representative Kahn being said was that the government doesn't want to wait for the rulemaking process to develop around this. They want to rush it through.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being late. The excuse was the marriage amendment press conference took precedence. But the you know, maybe what we should do is make all applications exempt from the rulemaking process if just drawing up an application is something that shouldn't be in the rulemaking process. Is that something that we ought to look at?
Madam Representative Kahn, possibly in a future bill, but I don't think we need to do that in this bill here. I don't think Representative Hillstrom would want like that tacked onto her bill.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Again, anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, all in favor of the bill, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Ayes have it. Bill passed as amended. And while Representative Purcell's coming down, we have a group here from 9th and 10th graders from the Great River School in St. Paul. And welcome to the committee. And Representative Purcell, we're back on House File 651. And I understand there's a DE2 amendment that was worked on overnight. And Representative Peffin, do you want to offer that? I understand you have a couple words you want to change in that or add to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would introduce the amendment, but would add the words one time on line 1.5 after the word A. So the state auditor, in consultation with the Minnesota Association of Townships and the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, may charge a one-time user fee to cities, etc. And then with that incorporation, I would offer the amendment.
Mr. Shepherd, do you have that? I'll accept that as a case. So Representative Peppin offers the DE2 amendment with the modification she made. All in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. And Representative Purcell, Mr. Xulam, proceed with what? Any more questions that we need? I think we were on questions yesterday. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having us back here. Going on the bill as amended now, I guess let's just see if anybody's got any further questions. I guess we're we're going to try and make it work.
And I have two names from yesterday still on the list, Representative O'Driscoll and then Representative Druskowski. Representative O'Driscoll, do you still have questions?
Pass.
Representative Druskowski.
Pass, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else have questions on the bill? Anybody from the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I think we should let Mr. Sulem speak because that one time, those two words are words that I put in, and I won't represent that it was part of whatever agreement he worked on. And the reason I just wanted to clarify that the reason I wanted to include those words is just so that's very clear. I don't believe the word a user fee is clear, that it's just one time. So I would like to give them a chance to speak in case they are not in favor of this.
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Representative Pepin, I think for now we're okay with the one time. I think the only issue that we may need to think about as we move into finances, would it be restrictive 20 years out if we need to rewrite the program a second time? Because I understand your intent, and that's been the testimony all along, and it's meant to be a one time at the time of purchase, and we actually played with some of that language yesterday as we discussed. So for now, I'm okay with it, but we may need to do just a little fine-tuning if we have concerns about what it might do 20 years out. So we're not too restrictive. If I may, Mr. Chair, I talked with Mr. Shepard right before we started the hearing. The League of Minnesota Cities would also need to be added to the list of people being consulted. I believe he has the oral amendment for that.
Mr. Shepard, can you state that amendment? And
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Sulem was referencing was adding the League of Minnesota Cities in two places in the amendment. It would be on page 1, line 4, after townships, insert, comma, the League of Minnesota Cities, comma, and then on page 1, line 15, after townships, insert, comma, the League of Minnesota Cities, comma, so that the auditor would consult with the League of Cities along with the Townships Association and the Association of Small Cities before doing any of this.
Representative Pepin, do you want to make that motion?
Yep, I will make that change. I'll move that oral amendment.
Representative Druskowski, did you have a question on that? All in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is approved. Representative Druskowski.
No, Mr. Chair, I was just going to offer the amendment.
Okay. So again, is there anybody else that wishes to speak for or against the amendment? Any more questions on the bill as amended? If not, all in favor of House File 651 as amended, please say aye.
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 All opposed? I'll get ahead of myself. The bill's approved, and it's going to go to state government finance.
Thank you.
And Representative Loeffler. Okay. I was looking at Liebling.
Good morning. She's moving around.
Yeah, I'm looking over there, and I'm saying your name.
We all get so much an opportunity to move is appreciated.
House File 542.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm honored to be here. I would appreciate someone on the committee moving the bill, and I have an amendment, the A3 amendment.
I'll move House File 542 to be before the committee, to be moved, and it's going to General Register. We got an A3 amendment. Is that your amendment?
That is my amendment, Mr. Chair.
I will move the A3 amendment to the author's amendment to put it in the form that the author wants. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and honored to be before your committee. We're privileged to have a state employee workforce that's skilled, talented, and dedicated as much as we are, perhaps more so, to serving the public. And what this bill tries to do is to better enable their skills and knowledge and to be used in designing and implementing effective and efficient services. And there'll always be a sort of creative tension, and there should be, between the executive and the legislative branches in the competition for ideas. But I think the taxpayers expect us to use the unique expertise in the field and knowledge of our state employee workforce in making decisions that help us shape and evaluate the development of public services so that they're efficient and effective. And we know that things can vary from agency to agency. They vary in size and complexity. But Section 1 of the bill, which was amended by the amendment, provides that employees in the classified staff, these are the people who are hired based on their expertise and knowledge and information, are to be seen as resources to both the executive and the legislative branches in making decisions, and that they can provide assistance to legislative decision makers in their area of expertise. We're not asking, you know, snowplow drivers to advise us on human service policies, and that they can consult with their direct supervisor in doing so, but that they need to have an ability to timely get back to us on our questions. And if we ask for confidentiality, that they should honor that, that they shouldn't, it shouldn't be leaked to providers or others who might be involved or affected in the decision. That's, of course, particularly important when we're weighing potential budget cut decisions that we may decide to back away from, but we want to gain some information on. The administration and its ideas in terms of the governor's budgets and policy proposals already have this protection in law, so that's why, you know, a governor can work on his budget proposal and not have what he's weighing leaked to the press or to others who might be interested in what's being considered. Section 2 provides that when a state employee provides information to a legislator, the legislative auditor, or a constitutional officer that they believe in good faith is truthful and accurate, that they can't be punished in any way for providing that information. And so that basically, Mr. Chair, explains the components of the bill. And with me is Kendall Killian, who can present some information from the perspective of the employees. Thank you.
Mr. Killian, please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kendall Killian. I am the Public Affairs Coordinator for MAPE, the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We represent over 13,000 state professional employees. MAPE supports House File 542 because it provides state employees with enhanced whistleblower protections, so they are protected when communicating with legislators. As Representative Loeffler said, she described this as Section 2 of the bill. This bill would strengthen whistleblower protections for state employees if they communicate with their legislators. This bill allows employees in the classified service to disclose information that an employee in good faith believes to be truthful and accurate and relates to state service or their finances to a legislator or a legislative branch employee without fear of retaliation or discipline. Each year, the MAPE Delegate Assembly, which is our annual convention, meets and determines our core legislative priorities. The current MAPE legislative priorities document, which was passed democratically by our members last fall, states directly that we support whistleblower protections like those covered in the bill. MAPE members are committed to making our state government operate efficiently and effectively. In fact, in 2010, MAPE members put forth ideas that would have together saved the state over $100 million. Our members want to make sure the state works as efficiently as possible, but to do that, they need protections in statute so when they communicate with you, they are protected. Our organization is committed to being part of the budget solution, both this biennium and in the future, and this will aid our efforts to put forth cost-saving solutions. Thank you.
Any questions of the testifier? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Killian and to the author. With the amendment, I just want to check if there's a couple things that would be covered to be protected under the whistleblower. We have, in addition to legislators, we have legislative boards and commissions. We have the legislative auditor. We have Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, Outdoor Heritage, LCC, a number of commissions that are in the legislative branch. So if a member asks through one of those commissions, and if there's communication with an executive branch employee, is that protected under the bill?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I think it should be because you're doing it in your legislative role, but I would defer to Mr. Shepherd, the counsel for the committee, to for a more definitive answer.
Mr. Shepherd, you get the question.
Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Hansen, were you speaking specifically of Section 1 of the bill, the communicate the duty of state employees to communicate, or this, or Section 2?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepherd, I was looking at the particularly at the amendment that went on and the you have to excuse me, I've got a cold here. But we've got legislative, we've got the confidentiality with a member of the legislature and legislative staff. We've got description of provide assistance to legislative decision makers. And in the bill, we've got legislator, legislative auditor, constitutional author. So I'm kind of, the question is, does legislative decision makers, is that broad enough to include legislative commission staff to acting on behalf of the legislature?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it would. I think that this would cover legislators in whatever role, as long as you're acting as a legislator. If you're acting as a member of a legislative commission or a commission that has legislative and citizen members, I think Section 1 would apply, the amended language would apply to, you would be a legislative decision maker, I believe, when you're making legislative decisions as part of the LCCMR. And in Section 2 of the bill, if an employee in the classified service is communicating information to a legislator, then I think that would be the case, too, if you were communicating to a legislator who was acting in his or her role on a legislative commission.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to just drill down a little more, Mr. Shepherd. So if I ask a commission staffer to ask the question, and the commission staffer is a member of a legislative commission acting on my behalf, and they contact, or there's contact with an executive branch employee, would that be protected under the bill? Or does it have to be the legislator to the employee?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, with regard to the new language of the amendment that was adopted in Section 1, the first part says that the state employees in the classified service are expected to provide information to legislative decision makers. If you are, as a legislative decision maker, are acting through an agent, through your legislative assistant or another legislative staff, I think that obligation would apply. I think the Section 2 is a little bit different. I think the whistleblower protection says that it protects an employee who communicates to a legislator. And so I'm not as certain that if somebody communicated something to a legislative staff person that that would be protected under Section 2, but I think in Section 1, as I read it, that would be, there would be a duty.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Shepherd. I'm just thinking about the practical reality. Sometimes we may ask in our busy day even a legislative assistant, but I was thinking more when I started this string of questioning about a staffer on a commission, could you check in on this, or could you contact the agency? So it wouldn't be the member directly. I think we've got on the record the Section 1 that would be protected. I would be interested in maybe the MAPE or the author's opinion on this particular part relating to Section 2.
Representative Leffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't have any problem with clarifying it. I would also note that on line 1.9 of the amendment that you adopted, it says to a member of the legislature or legislative staff acting on a member's request, and so that might be language that you might want to consider, but I am not. I defer to Mr. Shepherd as the legal expert on this as to the advisability of that, and I'm not sure if Mr. Killian has a comment.
No.
Mr. Killian. Representative Mr. Shepherd, do you think about that? Then,
yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, I think in Section 1, as I read it, the bill is expressing an expectation. It's saying that you're expected to communicate information to both executive and legislative decision makers. And as an expectation and as a requirement to provide assistance, I think it would be understood that you provide assistance to legislative decision makers by working through their staff often. I think, as I read Section 2, it's narrower. This is a very different, this is a legal requirement that gives people a legal right not to be discharged or discriminated against based on specific communication. And there can be a civil action brought for violation with damages and things. So it's a different kind of circumstance. And I think, as I read, it's up to the committee. I think it's a policy decision if you want to add legislative staff in that section. But as I read it right now, I think it applies only to the communication from a state employee to a legislator.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. The first I would like to direct to Mr. Killian. As a new member of the legislature, I'm unclear about, you mentioned the 13,000 professional employees that are covered by MAPE. And if you could please clarify, give me an idea of who those employees are, what roles do they serve?
Mr. Killian.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Our members do over 400 different jobs. They are IT professionals, members of all the state, or employees in all the state agencies, DNR, people that test the quality of our water, people that stock lakes and rivers with fish, people that, all sorts of things. MNSCU, academic professionals that work in state colleges and universities, the zoologists at the Minnesota Zoo. I mean, it's an extraordinary variety of different professional mm-hmm. jobs. Our members, kind of the distinguishment between our members and other classifications of employees are our members nearly exclusively have either 4-year or, in many cases, graduate degrees, and they do not manage other employees, which, is kind of a definition of being a rank and file member as a state employee as opposed to a management employee.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pugh.
Thank you. And my next question is for Representative Loeffler. I'm unclear about why this bill wouldn't include other classifications of employees. Why only classified employees?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh. That's a great question. And I did that because the classified employees are the people who are hired for their expertise and talent. They compete with people based on their degrees and their experience. The unclassified service includes political appointees, our commissioners and deputy commissioners who report to the governor. It includes people who are on short-term grants. If there's a short-term program that's only funded for 6 months or a year, it tends to be that most of the people whose expertise we would rely on in terms of shaping a policy is the person who has, was hired as an expert in that field and that we want to have access to that expertise. That might not be a complete description of all the potential classifications that could make that distinction, but that's the working knowledge that I have.
Representative Pugh.
It would seem to me that I appreciate your response. I'm comfortable that it would appear that to me that there are so many other members who employees who are not classified who, we are as legislators just so reliant upon. So, I'll have to digest that.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add on too. I think that we have access to can ask questions of anyone who's in state government. We work a lot with the commissioners and the deputy commissioners and people in the governor's office, and this does not change that. Unfortunately, there has gotten to be within, I think agencies have varied, but within some agencies, a tendency to want to say to the professionals, you can't talk to legislators. I mean, state experts and staff have been told that directly. And so I have, as a legislator, called up someone who's in charge of a program in anticipation of a hearing and asked basic factual questions. How many people are involved in this? How many cities are involved in this program? Just basic background information, and been told they can't give that to me. They have to fill out forms. It has to go through the whole process. And that has really made it more difficult for us sometimes to make informed decisions. And sometimes if the process is that you have to go through a legislative liaison in a very large, complex agency, that person, it's hard to understand all the programs in a large agency like the Department of Human Services or some of our larger agencies. Oftentimes, they don't have the background to even understand necessarily the question. It gets translated. It goes through these processes. You get back the answer in a period of time, and it's clear they didn't understand the question. And meanwhile, we don't have, as we all know, months to develop our legislative proposals. We oftentimes have very short time frames in which we have to get a bill through a committee, be able to answer questions from members, you know, decide whether or not to offer an amendment and how would it work. We even just on things like an effective date. Do you think that 6 months is a reasonable lead time for you and local governments to implement this change? Sometimes you have to make that choice fairly quickly. And so this is to say to the administration, we want to be able to get prompter answers from the experts. That doesn't mean they don't have to share that they have provided that to their supervisor. If they gave us misleading information or they didn't understand the context, we certainly want that corrected. But that we should streamline the process so it's more efficient given the pressures that are on us.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah, I just have one follow-up comment. I mean, this is my first experience in government, and you know what you shared with me is very disturbing. I am just still not clear that there's a need, you know, for this bill. I mean, if those matters, which it sounds like, you know, have in fact presented themselves, those issues, it would seem to me that there could be communication with one's supervisor to bring that matter to one's attention, and you know, I would like to hope that there could be lines of communication that could be opened. You know, I know that's how things happen in the private sector. That's my only experience, and so it is concerning. I'm just really not sure why there's a need for this bill.
Representative Siskowski.
And members, I can just say some of us have worked on this for years. This bill passed with bipartisan support in 2010. It was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. It has been an ongoing challenge, and I wish it wasn't true. I think it varies by agency, but I do think we do need to make state employees who are hired for their expertise feel comfortable that they can work with us.
Representative Siskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I had the same question about the classified. It appears four places in the bill that we are really focusing this bill on classified state employees. It seems short-sighted to really call out one particular group of employees and not make it applicable to all employees. I would expect there's a good number of unclassified employees that have a good amount of information, legislators and others, constitutional officers and others covered in this bill would want to have similar information and similar protections. So I don't know if you would be amenable to removing the places that the classified service or classified employees are called out in here to make it cover all employees, but I'd be willing to offer that amendment if you are.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kowski, at this point I'm not comfortable with that. I think we might get into some constitutional issues of separation of executive and legislative with some of the appointments, and so I think that would need a lot of research.
Representative Kowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I encourage you to do that research, Representative Loeffler, because this appears really to be focused on, again, on classified state employees, the employees that Mr. Killian represents, and not others. Question, Representative Loeffler, on Section 1 of the bill, on the amendment lines 1.6 and 1.7. The sentence says, consultation with a direct supervisor on the request may be required but shall not unduly slow the promptness of the reply. It seems really a muddled message there, not to mention a fuzzy piece to write into law. It seems like we are wanting these employees to come forward, yet at the same time somewhat appearing to limit or call into question the ability of the supervisor to make the determination about who within their department should be the person to respond. And I think we're creating more uncertainty here than certainty.
Representative Leffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Skowski. This really deals with the issues of workload, which I think is something that a supervisor has to balance. If we've asked a state employee to do some research on something or maybe do a computer run or whatever it is to get us some information, that might mean that the supervisor will want to make sure that someone else can take care of something else that's pressing. It also gives the supervisor a chance to say you may have a newer employee who doesn't understand the context. Maybe they weren't involved in a legal suit that has some bearing on the question. And so it's just to, you know, it allows for that consultation.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Loeffler, that's still not helpful. I think we're creating uncertainty in the law by putting this sentence in there. We're at one point telling them that they need to come forward and not be dragging their feet, but on the other notion, we're basically tying the hands of the supervisor to make the call as to who within their department is the best person to help that person. It may be that person X is a person contacted by a legislator around a commission around a question within that department, but person Y is the best person to answer the question. Therefore, the supervisor would say, you know what, we're going to have supervisor Y answer this question instead of employee Y instead of employee X. And so I don't know. I think that sentence either needs to be removed or needs more work.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments really just springboard right off of where Representative Drazkowski was. I'm concerned that the people that Mr. Killian represents could end up with a conflict of loyalty or duty. A legislator picks up the phone and calls and talks to that individual and says, I need to have A, B, C, and D. I'm working on a proposal. Well, that person may have also received that same request but from another side of an issue. And now they've got two legislators or multiple inquiries on that. Their manager or supervisor has given them a workload and a set of priorities to work on in that day or that week or that month, which encompasses the entire mission of the enterprise. I think that's one of the reasons why many of our agencies have developed legislative liaisons or government affairs to be able to be the intake, to be able to manage all of those requests that come from the legislature. I do believe legislators should be able to have access to the information, but I also think we have to have a respect of a process because there are so many inquiries that will be coming into many of these different agencies that could really create some challenges, I think, for those employees. Do I be loyal to the call of a legislator or to my supervisor or employer? And if we start getting a little bit deeper into this, if they drop their workload because they feel that they need to honor the request of a legislator because their supervisor might not be immediately available to answer that question or give them authority to shuffle up their workload, I fear that we could have unintended consequences with a reprimand, you didn't do what I asked you to do, and that might be something that kind of circles again in the bill with the whistleblower, some of the other kinds of things that are here. I think the idea is very noble. I'm just wanting to make sure that we can give our managers and supervisors within state agencies the authority to be able to prioritize the workload, but not to unduly stand in front of a request of a legislator. And I just think that everybody works better under those kinds of circumstances.
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Mr. O'Driscoll, I think that makes the point of why you need to have some consultation there. At the same time, respect the need of the legislature. And I think of us our unclassified experts in some ways like House Research. They get questions from both sides. They have to manage workload. And it's about a an open relationship. I mean, that you can call a legislator and say, do you need this for a bill that's coming up this week, or could we get back to you next week? I mean, there's a management aspect to any kind of work demands, and I think we have the people who can manage that effectively in communications with us. But so that's, I think, workable.
Representative Driscoll. Representative Freiberg.
Just to kind of to that point about a potential conflict of interest, I see a couple provisions that are already in existing law here that are cited in our copy of the bill on line 2.4, 2.5. Protects employees if they are requested by a public body or office to participate in an investigation, hearing, or inquiry. To me, it seems like that could relate to a legislator. On line 215, 216, it says that protects a public employee who shares a scientific study, and then it says including reports to a governmental body or law enforcement official. I mean, are you aware of any situations where, you know, those have been in existing law, I assume, for a while. Are you aware of any situations where a conflict has developed over those provisions?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg, I'm not familiar with all those. I interpreted lines 2.4 and 2.5 to talk about a legal hearing, a legal investigation, that sort of thing, not so much a legislative hearing. But this is really about the steps before that, too, in terms of gaining information before you may decide, based on information you gain, not to bring something to a public body. Or it may not have to do with a technical study that has been done. It may be, like I say, even just about participation rates or, you know, other issues that may arise that I don't think this would cover currently.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, I guess my only point is just that there are provisions already in law relating to communicating with public bodies. This seems consistent with that. So it doesn't, at least in my mind, it doesn't cause a huge problem. And I guess that's more of a comment than a question.
I have another testifier here on my list, Ms. O'Brien, from Assistant Commissioner from Minnesota Management and Budget. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann O'Brien, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Enterprise Human Resources for Minnesota Management and Budget. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this bill today and to share some of our concerns with you. I understand that this is an important component of being a state employee, that they will get involved in situations where their expertise is required. And we support the fact that people should be able to have the ability to talk to legislators. But we also appreciate the fact that the concerns that we have are that it would require an employee to keep this information possibly from their employer when contributing to opinions on matters that are important for the decision makers to have all of the information in making their decisions going forward. Also, we believe that there are protections currently under the Whistleblower Act that do allow the employee to have the ability to speak to those legislators who are asking questions, with the understanding that they would be able to refer additional questions on to management of the organization. We believe that this is a problem that is a solution where we haven't seen a huge problem. The bill limits executive branch's authority to manage the information and personnel and could impair its ability to do the job. As a practical matter, as we develop positions on financial planning, on budgeting, and negotiations, the process goes through many iterations of and different decision points during those iterations. And it's important, and often those are rejected for good reasons. Sometimes the people who have contributed to those decisions have not been aware of the totality of the situations that they are discussing. So they don't have the most recent information. They may not have the most recent information or all of the facts that were made or used by the decision makers. There has been situations in state agencies. There's one that I was aware of where the state agency investigated the outcome of an incident. One of the employees on the team disagreed with a final decision of the investigation group on the details of the incident. When the agency was asked to testify before Congress on their findings, the employee also testified. The employee was not disciplined or discharged, but that resulted in a lawsuit against the state by both involved insurance companies because the state had presented two contrary opinions. So when a decision is made, we want and encourage employees to bring their decisions or disagreements forward to management in making their decision prior to that final decision being made. An employee could be put in a difficult spot, as you've discussed, to keep a legislative inquiry confidential under this language if it resulted in them providing an opinion about a topic where they were not as knowledgeable as others about that topic. We prefer to focus on improving the flow of information between the legislative and executive branches and address any concerns you may have directly rather than creating broad legislation that could cause issues in other areas. There are, we believe, already sufficient protections in law for employees under Section 181 for employees to provide information to government bodies. Thank you.
Any questions of the testifier? If not, is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify for or against the bill? Representative Hansen, are you working on?
Here. An oral amendment.
That's what I thought. That's why I asked. Okay, 200. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and the provision we're looking at is at on line 2.20 and the bill. I'm just going to describe before I move. So the issue we're dealing with is the author had talked about maybe having or legislative staff acting as a member's request. But we could have legislative staff receiving information that are not acting as on the member's request. So the issue here is we have legislative commissions, boards, and staff where they could take a phone call that is a whistle, providing information, and then be punished because they didn't get in contact with the actual legislator. And we want to, my intent would be to have the coverage of legislative branch employees to be able to receive that information, and the executive branch employees would be covered under the whistleblower for providing that information to legislative branch employees. That is all a mouthful. So I think the simplest way to correct it would be on line 2.20. After the word legislator, insert comma, strike the word or. After the word auditor, replace the semicolon with a comma, insert the words a legislative employee, semicolon, before the or. And to see if Mr. Shepherd would have that, and if the author would
Mr. Shepherd.
Comment.
Mr. Chair, I think I have it, and just to make it easier for you to understand, you might express it as page 2, delete line 20, and then insert the small Roman numeral 1, a legislator, comma, the legislative auditor, comma, or a legislative employee, semicolon, or. then the whole.
I would move that for simplicity and seek the author's opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and based on the previous discussion, I think this helps clarify the situation.
Anybody have questions on the amendment? Representative Sanders, or comfortable with it? So, Representative Hatch, you move that amendment? Okay, all in favor of the oral amendment on line 2.20 as described by Mr. Shepherd, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion of the amendment's adopted. Any more questions, further questions on the bill as amended? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 542 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor of that amendment or that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. The bill is going on its
way. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. And Representative Liebling had to step out for another, but she's going to be right back. I have Mr. Griffin here, who will come down and speak on the bill. So I will move House File 328 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota chapter of the March of Dimes, and I have with me our State Director of Government Programs and Services, Martha Overby. Mr. Chairman and members, House File 328 is a bill that renews the task force on prematurity, and I do have my phone off, Mr. Chairman, so I will note that for the record. This is a task force that was put together 2 years ago. Representative Abler was the chief author, and Representative Huntley was a co-author on it. One of the things that we are very interested in at the March of Dimes, having worked to cure polio and invented neonatal intensive care units, is to try and limit the damage that is done by premature and preterm birth. And so we have pulled together a task force that we have done voluntarily with a coalition called the Prematurity Coalition, and this task force has been tasked with trying to find ways of reducing prematurity. Mr. Chairman, to put this bill in the form that the author would like it, and to take a suggestion that Representative Loeffler asked us in the last committee, there is an author's amendment that you have before you today, and if I could ask members, perhaps you, Mr. Chairman, to move that, and that will put the bill in the author's preferred form.
Do the
and
members have the amendment?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, did you move the bill yet?
Yes, I moved the bill.
Where is
it
going?
It's going to Health and Human Services Finance. And I'll move the amendment, the A2 amendment, to put it in the form the author wants. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's adopted. The bill's amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to speak to the amendment very quickly, Representative Loeffler suggested that we might not be able to ensure the elimination of prematurity in the task force, and we said she was right. That's why the word promoting was substituted, and the and was simply a technical change from staff. The last was a request from the Republican minority members in the Senate that they be informed of the task force report. I'm going to turn the testimony over very briefly to Ms. Overby to tell you about the bill.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Martha Overby, and I'm the State Director of Program Services and Government Affairs for the March of Dimes. The bill, as Mr. Griffin indicated, it's an extension for 2 years, in essence for a task force that has already been in existence for 2 years. As outlined, there are various representatives that would be a part of, continue to be a part of this task force, as outlined, 15 representatives from Minnesota Prematurity Coalition. And I've actually provided as well, I hope, there's a listing of the coalition members that hopefully is helpful for you, so you can see the different areas that we draw upon because of the complexity of the issue. As well as one representative from that is appointed by the Commissioner of Health Services, two representatives appointed by the Commissioner of Health, one representative appointed by the Commissioner of Education, two members, House of Representatives, and two from Senate, as well as then just simply outlining the duties, as you can see. And as I say, it's pretty straightforward. It's simply extending the task force for another 2 years. And the reason we'd like to do this, what makes it significant as well for all of you, is 1 in 10 babies in the state of Minnesota are born prematurely. So 10%. We're slightly better than other states in that nationally it's 1 in 8 babies. It's a bipartisan committee. Nationally, $26.2 billion were spent in 2005 on premature infants. That translates roughly into 51,600 per infant that is born preterm. In Minnesota, in 2011, we had 6,980 preterm births. So that translates into about $360 million for the state. So it's a complex issue, and it's also an expensive issue. So that's why we would like to continue the task force for another 2 years. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for either one of you, I'm just wondering, why are you removing 4, 5, and 6 that all have to do with evidence-based research? Why wouldn't you want to use that as part of the consideration? So you took considering the following, and then you don't want to consider evidence-based medicine anymore, and I'm no expert in the field, and I'm just wondering why.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, the reason for removing those is that the task force has actually accomplished some of the work that it was set out to do. And so in the report, we've been working with the various hospital organizations, hospitals themselves, and other groups within the coalition to set out what those systems are and what they should be for doing the checklists, if you will. And I'm also not a medical expert, but we've established those guidelines and are distributing them and working with them to make sure that they're out there. So we believe that some of the work that the task force was assigned to do has already been accomplished.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, just a technical item on line 2.8. Should we not be deleting the word "to" after "inherence" so that the after "adherence"? Excuse me, so that the sentence reads properly.
2.8, ensuring adherence to standards.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I read something wrong.
That's an addition to the. That's not a deletion.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just point out one other thing. We are headed to the Finance Committee, but the bill has no fiscal impact. We've had this group together prior to the establishment and statute. We asked for the state's blessing to do this, but we have voluntarily staffed this organization so that there is no fiscal cost to this. And I have had some members who have expressed to me, why do you need to have our blessing to meet? We don't necessarily, but we think it helps bring people together, and we appreciate that greatly. And I believe I'm joined by one of the co-authors of our bill, Representative Norton, who I appreciate.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Norton, and we're just on questions, and we've put the amendment on so you know where we're at. Any other questions on the bill for the testifiers? Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions about the bill. I've had more of a questions about the handout, the March of Dimes handout. And, wow, I look at my legislative district up in the Northeast. We have, like, that's really a lot. I read what allegedly causing that. It somewhat resembles the district. What can be done about it?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, I think you put your finger on the problem, and that is what we're asking the task force to really look at. The causes of premature birth are complex, to say the least, and as you might guess, they're associated with socioeconomic factors, with health factors, with access factors, and all of those feed into what we're doing. Trying to figure out ways of reorganizing our system better is one of the things the task force is about, but I would be overly optimistic if I were to suggest to you that we have answers for all of these questions. We are working very, very hard at the March of Dimes to try and come up with new ways of working with the providers that actually do the delivery of care. One of the things that's happened in the past few years that many of you may have heard of and that people in Representative Norton's district have been extremely involved in is trying to work with providers to make sure that we don't do unnecessary deliveries, for instance, C-sections, before they actually need to be done. Some of them, and I don't want to cast aspersions at providers because I don't think they're doing it just because they're going on vacation or some such thing, but there is a push by some mothers to say, I'd like to have the baby delivered a little bit earlier because of discomfort, because of other factors. We're working with providers to say, don't do those kinds of things. And it's been very, very successful. Those number of unnecessary C-sections have dropped dramatically in the state, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but would be happy to provide you with that as an example of some of the things that we're doing. But this is an issue that is going to be around even after the task force expires in 2 years.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. I'm just looking at that map, and when I first looked at it, I thought, boy, this is a real rural problem. Because I'm looking up in Representative Fabian's district, Representative Marquardt's district, down in the southwest, Representative Hamilton's district in that area, mine, but then through that center piece as well. Boy, there's got to be some commonality in there why that's happening. Interesting that the metro is less. And Representative Norton, you must be doing a good job because look down in your district, you're the lowest. So anyway, there.
It looks like
it's an interesting map, and I just wanted to really bring attention to it.
Representative Dill, it looks like it's access to health care and maybe poverty.
Yeah.
So, any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 328 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Committee, and it's going there because they've requested it. So, all in favor of House of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion approved. The bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
And with that, members, I think we don't have the minutes. They weren't done from the yesterday, so we'll do those at our next meeting. Otherwise, on our agenda for the next Tuesday's meeting, we've got three bills. They're posted: House File 414, House File 310, and House File 84. So, members,
sorry. Did you repeat that?
It's House File 414, 310, and 84. And they should have got an email out. They were posted yesterday. So, that's for the meeting on Tuesday. If there's nothing else before the committee, we're adjourned.